Okay, so this week's Parsha is Parsha's Vayikra, and we know that Vayikra begins the Torah's discussion of the karbanos, of the sacrifices, and sacrifices were only possible with the Beis HaMikdash, and as we know, tefillah, prayer, is our replacement for karbanos. The pasuk says, "Neshama parm sefasenu," we will make up for the cows with our lips, which refers to davening, tefillah. The Gemara tells us, tefillahs keneged temidin tignum, that our prayers were instituted corresponding to the daily tamid, to the daily the sacrifice that was brought every day and every evening. So there is a clear connection between the sacrifices and davening. And therefore, I'd like to dedicate some time of the class tonight to davening, to tefillah. And specifically what I want to talk about is that if we say that tefillah, prayer, is what replaces the sacrifices, so what status did prayer have when we had sacrifices? What kind of status did it have? As we know, the text that we have for davening, the order of davening, what we incorporate in our davening, the laws of davening, these were instituted by the Anshei Knesset HaGedolah, men of the Great Assembly. These were all instituted by the sages.
After the second Temple was destroyed.
At the beginning of the second Beis HaMikdash. Before the Chacham, before the sages instituted a text, before they instituted a formal form for our davening, so what did davening look like? Where did it come from? What did it look like? Okay. So I want to share with you from the words of Rav Shimon Schwab Zatzal. Shimon Schwab was the Rav of Kaladas Yeshurin in the Washington Heights section of Manhattan, the famous German shul. And he used to give a class on tefillah, on the prayers. He would go through all the tefillahs that we zaven and explain them and speak about them. And his classes were then put into a book called Rav Schwab on Prayer. And there's an introduction that they have printed here from Rav Schwab Zatzal. And I want to share with you what he says, and he covers these questions. Now, according to the Rambam, according to Maimonides and other opinions, there is a mitzvah min haTorah. There is a mitzvah from the Torah to daven. The Torah obligates us to daven. The Torah doesn't tell us how many times to daven. They don't tell us what to daven. They don't tell us when to daven. But it tells us to daven. Where is that? We actually say it every day in the second paragraph of Shema. When we say, Ula avdei b'chol avavchem, and to serve God with all your hearts. The Gemara says, how do you serve God with your heart? The answer is, tefillah, prayer. And according to the Rambam and other opinions, this is where the Torah obligates us to daven. Okay? So even while there were still karbanos, according to the Rambam and others, there are those who argue, but according to the Rambam and others, there, the status of prayer before, when we still had karbanos, there was an obligation to prayer. There was an obligation to pray. There was an obligation every day to focus yourself on Hashem, and I guess that means then make your requests, give thanks, and this was an obligation. So even before we had a standard form of how and when we actually do the how and when we daven, the how and when was up to us.
Well, then why is it that they say replace sacrifices in lips? Then it's not
because at the end of the day, wait. The answer would be though that after we didn't have sacrifices anymore, our prayers became replacement for that. So you're right. Prayer has a place on its own. It's its own mitzvah, but it also became a replacement for the sacrifices. Okay. So again, even when we had the sacrifices, it's pretty clear. It's clear at least from the Rambam and other opinions that we always had an obligation to pray. How to pray? When to pray? That the Torah doesn't tell us. But it tells us to pray. We have a mitzvah of tefillah. Now, as I mentioned before, we know that the actual the formal text that we use nowadays for our davening, whether it be the authoring of the Shemoneh Esrei, whether it be how the order of the davening, Pesukah deZimra, what we say, Kedusha, Kaddish, when to say these things, the laws that govern all these parts of our prayer, these things were all instituted by the Anshei Knesset Gedolah. They gave it an official form. Okay, but we do know that there was davening before this. So what did it look like? Now, Rav Schwab tells us, and this is again giving us some background here, that the, as we've mentioned, the formal text of prayer, when and how we do it, that was instituted by the Anshei Knesset Gedolah, the men of the Great Assembly. The men of the Great Assembly lived at the beginning of the second Beis HaMikdash. That is when this body came together. They came together at the beginning of the second Beis HaMikdash, and the last of that of the Anshei Knesset Gedolah that we read in Pirkei Avos is Shimon HaTzadik. Shimon HaTzadik was during the time of the second Beis HaMikdash. So the period of the Anshei Knesset Gedolah spanned the time of the second Beis HaMikdash. The Gemara tells us that it consisted of 120 elders. Among those 120 elders, there were many prophets. Many prophets. The last prophets, Chag Zecharia Malachi, were members of the Anshei Knesset Gedolah. There were other prophets that were members of the Anshei Knesset Gedolah. And it's this body of sages with prophets amongst them, who were sages too. They were the ones who instituted the davening. And clearly, if they're the ones who instituted the davening, says Rav Schwab, it's important to understand what they wanted from us, what was the meaning of what they instituted for us. It clearly means something we have to study. Now, then he goes into why did these sages institute a specific form of prayer and not let it go like it was before. I mean, apparently before the Ashkenaz Sagdan, people were davening, they chose what they wanted to daven. Maybe they made up their own. They said Tehillim, they chose things from Tehillim. You know, that's what we would speculate that they did. But again, if it's not Ashkenaz Sagdaila, they gave a formal text, that would mean that people were davening without that formal text. Well, if they're getting along without the formal text, why do they feel a necessity to do it? So he explains like this. He starts off with the Gemara in Sanhedrin that tells us that the Anshei Knesset Gedolah made a decision, and through their prayers, the Yetzer Hara, the evil inclination, the desire for idol worship, was removed. We have no understanding of why did the people want to worship idols. But it's very clear that from the Torah, idol worship was a big problem. There's constant warnings of it. Every day in Shema, we say, Hishamu lachem v'nifel v'abchem v'saratem v'atem v'lohim acherim v'shtachavisim lahem. A warning. Make sure you're not seduced after idol worship. When you go through Tanakh, constantly the Jewish people succumb to idol worship. There was always this back and forth. There was always this battle between idol worship and the Jewish people, in the sense that the Jewish people always succumbed very often to idol worship. And we don't really have a full understanding of what idol worship was about, but apparently it was a very seductive power. It was something that was very convincing. As to maybe somehow or another, mystically it gave people a high. Perhaps there was a way of connecting to certain types of, supernatural powers that are called Kaychas Hatuma, the impure powers that exist. Again, it's not clear. We don't know, we don't know what it is because we've never experienced it. We haven't experienced it because the Anshei Knesset Gedolah made a decision and they realized the Jewish people will not be able to hold out. We're getting smaller. The idol worship and the desire for idol worship is still going strong, and it's going to destroy the Jewish people. There's a famous Gemara that talks about one of the most infamous kings of the Jewish people was the King Menashe. Menashe eventually did tshuva, but the question is whether his tshuva was enough to help him. And the Gemara says that for whatever reason, the Chachamim conversed with his neshama. And it seems that for some reason, I don't remember the exact details of the Gemara, but they had a halacha question. They posed it to him. He answered it. It was a question they couldn't answer. He answered it. And they basically said to him, "You're such a Talmud Chacham. What happened to you?" So he said to them, "If you would have been living in my time, you would have lifted up the bottom of your garments so you could run faster to get to the idol worship." Meaning he said, "You have no idea what it was about." That's what he's saying to them. "You have no idea how strong a force, how strong a temptation idol worship was. You have no idea." And it was a big problem. So much so that the Tanchinetzta Gdaila decided, that's it. Jewish people can't hold out anymore. And they prayed to Hashem. The Yetzahara, the evil inclination of idol worship, was removed. Goodbye. No more. We may have to deal with wrong philosophies, corrupt philosophies, atheists, whatever it is that we have to deal with. But idol worship in its original form, we don't have that. That's gone. Because it was too much, it was too strong a temptation with the Jewish people, and the Anshinesh Sagadayla realized something has to be done, they eradicated it. So says Rav Schwab, with that eradication of idol worship, it actually had an effect on something very positive amongst the Jewish people. And he brings that from the Vilna Gaon, that the Vilna Gaon frequently writes that the Yetzahara of idolatry was related to the power of prophecy. And once the evil inclination of idol worship was eliminated, the power of prophecy ended as well. With the passing of the prophets Haggai and Malachi, their prophecy ended, and with it the Tanakh was completed. Megillas Esther was now written with prophecy, the Gemara says. It was written with Ruach HaKodesh. Meaning even after there's no prophecy, there is still something called the Baskal, the heavenly voice. There's something called Ruach HaKodesh, a spirit of holiness, which have to them prophetic properties of sorts. But it's not prophecy in the way, in the effect that, as Rav Schwab puts it, prophecy is where Hashem directly speaks to someone. It's a direct communication from Hashem to a person. And Baskal Ruach HaKodesh is, well, I would say Ruach HaKodesh is a elevated state of perception that goes beyond your typical perception, which Nevuah was way beyond. Nevuah was a form of perception that took you way beyond the limits of the human perception. And Ruach HaKodesh does that also to a certain degree. There's what's called Baskal, heavenly voice. Also a certain type of revelation. But not that kind of a direct communique that would come from Hashem to a person as Nevuah was. And therefore, it was a lower level of communication. So there were these other forms of things that were similar to prophecy, but actual prophecy wasn't there. Megillas Esther, the Gemara says, was written with Ruach HaKodesh. Because it was written with Ruach HaKodesh, Esther wrote it, Mordechai and Esther wrote it with Ruach HaKodesh, it therefore could be incorporated in Tanakh. And it only was incorporated in Tanakh when the Anshei Yetzirah HaGedolah agreed for it to be incorporated. But once the last prophets of the Anshei Yetzirah HaGedolah passed away, the Tanakh was closed. Nothing more can be incorporated into Tanakh. But says from the Gaon that there is a connection between the two. There's a connection between idol worship and prophecy. Once idol worship is gone, prophecy is gone. And once the Anshei Yetzirah HaGedolah eradicated idolatry, then prophecy would cease to exist.
How do you eradicate?
Their prayers. That means Hashem changed our nature. Whatever it was that tempted us to idol worship, that free will that we had, that there would be a temptation to idol worship, gone. It doesn't mean anything to us anymore. That's through their prayers. Now, I always understood that prophecy became diminished once the Beis HaMikdash was destroyed. But we know that there were prophets after the first Beis HaMikdash was destroyed. So prophecy did continue into part of the second Beis HaMikdash. According to what Rav Schwab has been down from the Vilna Gaon, once there was no more idol worship, Avodah Zarah, there would be no more Nevuah. Because actually, we find many often, and this is my understanding, that we find very often a concept called Zeh L'umah Zeh, one against the other. For every power of good, there is a power of evil that corresponds to challenge it. For every power of evil, there is a corresponding power of good to challenge it. The powers that go against each other in our discussion are prophecy and idol worship. They both counteract each other. They both give the possibility for bechira, for choice. And therefore, once the Yetzirah of idol worship was taken away, then to allow Nevuah to remain would create an imbalance in bechira. It would create an imbalance in our ability to choose between right and wrong. Because you've got this power of Nevuah that's so powerful, and you don't have anything to counter it. And therefore, once the sages decided that there would be no more evil inclination for idol worship, Nevuah had to be suspended. Because of the fact that you're not going to have, there'll be no more challenge anymore. There has to be a challenge. There has to be one against the other. There has to always be the challenge between Tov and Ra. And if Nevuah is going to exist on its own, it will take away the balance. It'll take away the equilibrium that has to exist between good and bad, so that we have bechira.
Well, but the bad still was there. So
a different type of bad, but not the bad of idol worship.
Right,
not the bad of idol worship. Idol worship, for whatever it was the counterforce to prophecy.
Do you think the sages of the Great Assembly knew that this will happen?
Yes.
Oh, so why didn't they hold on for another couple of years?
Because I'm going to assume that it's because they felt
they couldn't wait,
it had to be done. So as we'll talk, we'll see that what you're saying is true. They realized what was going to happen. Okay, that's what we're leading into. Now, so now we've established that principle that once the idol worship is eliminated, so prophecy is going to have to stop. Now, Schwab says, brings on a famous Gemara in Megillah. The Gemara Megillah says, "Harbe neviim amdu lahem liYisrael kiflayim kiyotzei Mitzrayim." There were many prophets that arose amongst the Jewish people, double the amount of people who left Egypt. Now, when we talk about prophets, we talk about 48 prophets and 7 prophetesses. I said that word right.
What about this whole city of prophets?
What else? City of prophets?
During David times, that was destroyed.
No, that was Kohanim.
What?
No, the Erhat Kohanim.
Yeah, but I thought they were sort of all the religious.
Well, I'm not familiar with that. And that was by Shaul. He
right.
Killed those, no, the Erhat Kohanim.
Mm-hmm.
The Gemara is saying that although we only know of 48 male prophets and 7 female, but that was a minuscule amount compared to the rest of the prophets that there were. Now, the difference between those prophets and the other prophets is that the prophets that we know of, they were given prophecies that would be messages for the Jewish people for eternally. So Yeshaya, Yirmiyah, Treyasar, the prophecies of those people, their prophecies were prophecies that were meant to be to be part of the Torah. It was going to be a prophecy that would have a message for the Jewish people for all generations. Those are the ones whose prophecies were recorded. But the ones who prophesied either just as an experience, maybe they had a message to deliver, but only specifically for that time or for those people, they weren't recorded. But the Gemara tells us they were double, the amount of prophets that the Jewish people had was double the amount of the people who left Egypt. How many people left Egypt?
600,000
is the number we give. That means that over a period of again, I don't know exactly how many years we would say this, right? But thinking about from the time that the Jewish people left Mitzrayim, received the Torah, and by the time, you know, at a certain point during the second Beis HaMikdash, prophecy stopped. How many years is that? I'm really not good at the years thing. I think it's about 800 years, right? It's about 800 years. So think about it. Double the amount of people left Egypt means 1,200,000.
How many people
right?
were there then?
Okay, so even spanning 800 years, right, to have over 1 million prophets, right, with how many people in general were there?
20 million.
Okay, well, I don't know. I don't know how many people. There weren't. There's no 20 million in Israel now, right? And we're talking about all within one area. Eretz Yisrael, and maybe spreading a little bit further out during the times of the second Beis HaMikdash. Okay? So that's a lot of people. That's a lot of prophets. So Reb Schwab suggests, he says, if I may say so, that would mean if you have 12 million prophets amongst the Jewish people, even for that amount of time.
1,000,002.
Excuse me?
1,000,002 prophets.
It's 1,200,000. Okay? If you, to have that many prophets means that part of the spiritual makeup of the Jewish people is prophecy. That means that prophecy is part of the chemistry of the Jewish people. There was an instinctive potential for prophecy. Was everybody a prophet? No. But if you could have so many prophets amongst that kind of, so you could have so many prophets amongst that kind of a nation. That he says that's a nation that prophecy is part of its chemistry, it's part of its essence. It's part of their spiritual makeup.
Helps you survive.
And therefore, if that's what it does, then that means the same way that prophecy gives us a, like I said before, a highly elevated perception beyond the normal human capacity. Even if I don't experience prophecy, but if prophecy is part of my potential, part of my makeup. That means that I automatically have a higher perception. I'm automatically in an elevated state, and I have a higher perception. And did everybody become prophets? No. There was a kind of prophet. Becoming a prophet is its own thing. It's its own art form. You know, it takes a lot to become a prophet. Not everybody went in that direction. But if you can have so many prophets amongst the people, then that has to mean that prophecy was part of their spiritual makeup, which means that they were in an elevated state in general. Therefore, says Rav Schwab, you want to know why the sages decided that now they needed to form a text, that to give an official form for the prayers, but beforehand people could make up their own? If everybody has this kind of prophetic nature to them, then they can make their own prayers. They're okay. They'll be able to make their own prayers. But once that was lost, because once idol worship stopped, prophecy stopped, then this spiritual makeup of prophecy is no more part of the Jewish people as a whole. I mean, the Jewish people have now fallen from their level of perception. If so, the sages said, okay, now we need to make an official form for prayer, because people don't have the ability anymore on their own to make the prayers that are necessary. Now they needed the sages to do that. At the same time, right? But we know that, as the Gemara says, when the Shemona Esrei was instituted by the men of the Great Assembly, the prophets, there were still prophets there. Chagi Zechariah Malachi, the final prophets, they were still there when they instituted the prayers. Why? Because they knew what was coming. Because they knew what was coming, they knew that prophecy was going to end, therefore, they already beforehand began creating the official form of prayer, because the Jewish people wouldn't be able to create the prayers on their own, because they lost that spiritual chemistry, that spiritual makeup of prophecy that was part of them.
Have you changed much since the form of the institute? Has it changed much over the years?
Well, you know,
they added things, right?
I'm sorry.
They added things,
but then you have like I can't go into it right now. But you know that different nusachos have words in Shemona Esrei a little bit different, right? You've got nusach Ashkenaz, nusach Sfar, Sfardim. You know, there's a lot of different. You know, there's words. You know, when and how when these words were changed? Is it a question what to say? What has a is there a question in the tradition? That's a separate discussion on its own. But we know that as a whole, right? Things are basically the same, right? You see, the Shemoneh Esrei is primarily the same. The fact, the order of things in many ways is the same. I mean, everybody has a Pesukah de Zimra and a Berachos Kriyas Shema and a Shemoneh Esrei. Everybody has that. Now again, what's the order of the Pesukah de Zimra? That could be there's different practices about. But it, clearly there are, excuse me, many, you know, there's much more in common than not in common because that was instituted by the Shemitz HaGdolah. Now he also brings out that we should realize that even when the Jewish people, you know, were on this high level, that prophecy was part of their spiritual makeup, and therefore we say they could decide on their own their prayers, at the same time the Gemara says, why was the first place of Mikdash destroyed? Avodah Zarah, Gilui Raayos, V'Chasdamim. Okay? Which means that even in this higher state, you still can have jealousy, and you can still can have lust, and you can still have desires. They're not mutually exclusive. I would add, again, this is my own addition, that, you know, if the Jewish people were on such a high level because of this, you know, because of this inherent, you know, potential for prophecy, well, then if they did slip up in Shvichas Tamim and murder, Gilui Arayis, and in illicit relationships, either somehow or another we have to say that the murder they committed was not regular murder, or for them it was a level of murder, I'm not sure how you'd say that. Or, again, you know, if there's going to be Bechir, if there's going to be free will, if you're going to have the potential to be on such a high level because prophecy, because your makeup is to have the potential for prophecy if you're on an elevated level, well then you still need to be, you have to be challenged, there has to be Bechir. Which means that the other things that exist as challenges had to have been very strong. They have to have been very strong. You know, in some ways we look at certain people and you say, could such a person ever fall into a terrible act of lust? You know, I mean, everybody's human, right? But would you believe that such a person would fall into such an act of lust? Well, maybe in those times, right, the lust was on a higher level. It was at a greater intensity. The Yetzirah for that was greater because there has to be that balance. There has to be that Bechira. If you're gonna be on a very high level, yet you have a very high spiritual potential for Bechira to exist, the other side has to have power too. And therefore, yes, you could be at a higher spiritual level, but it doesn't mean that the human challenges that everybody has existed, that those challenges did exist then too. And they had those challenges, and we actually see from the Gemara, the first Beis HaMikdash was destroyed because they didn't hold out. So again, there is the concept, and this is what Rav Schwab is saying. When prophecy existed, everybody was on a higher spiritual level, everyone had a higher perception, and therefore they can go ahead and make their own prayers. The sages didn't need to make prayers. At the same time, it's clear that even at a high spiritual level, they still had the Eitz Sahara of lust, of looking for honor, of Avodah Zarah itself was still there, right, by the first Beis HaMikdash, because the Eitz Sahara at that point wasn't removed. But that's what he's trying to say. He's saying that therefore, with this potential of the Vua that existed, the Jewish people, when the Torah says, right? The mitzvah to bench, mitzvah to bless Hashem after a meal. Torah obligation. Torah says, you eat, you're satisfied, you bless. How do you bless? What do you say? Torah doesn't say. The Torah left it up to us. At that point of time, the Torah could leave it up to us. At the same time, we do find the Gemara says that the first blessing of the Berachas HaMazon was instituted by Moshe. The second one, which is the blessing over the land, was instituted by Yeshua. The third blessing about Yerushalayim was instituted by David HaMelech. So you see from the Gemara that in an early point of time, there were sages that were directing us how to bless. But Rav Schwab says it still doesn't mean that the exact wording was there. It doesn't mean, though, that Moshe gave us the exact wording of the first bracha. He told us what our bracha should be talking about. And David Amel, and Yeshua told us another thing that should be talking about. And David Amel told us a third blessing that should be said. These are the blessings that we should be saying as part of our benching. But does that mean that Moshe gave the exact wording? Yeshua gave the exact wording? David gave the exact wording? Not necessarily. They gave us what we should be saying, what should be incorporated, what concept should be incorporated in the benching, but not necessarily the wording. That's why I understand what he's saying. Okay, so again, his point is that, so our question was, if we know that the Anshanet Sagdaila gave us a text, gave us a form, gave us an order for davening, and we know that we know that people davened before that, and we know there was a mitzvah, according to many opinions, we had an obligation to daven. So that would have to mean that before the Anshanet Sagdaila, the people made up their own prayer and said on their own what to say. So then why did the Anshanet Sagdaila decide to make a formal text? And the answer is because as long as the Nevuah did exist, as long as the Yetzer, the evil inclination for Avodah Zarah existed, then prophecy would exist. As long as prophecy was around, we can make our own prayers. But once the Anshanet Sagdaila eradicated the evil inclination for idol worship, and because of that now prophecy would end, in anticipation of that, the sages understood we're not going to be on that level anymore without prophecy that permeated the Jewish people. Whether they were prophets or not. The fact that there were so many prophets shows us that prophecy was part of the chemistry of the Jewish people, which gave them that elevated state, that was going to end the minute of the Great Assembly saw. And therefore, realizing that now the Jewish people wouldn't have the ability to create the proper prayers on their own, that is when they instituted a formal text for us to daven from that point on forever until Mashiach comes. Now, Shabbat brings from the Chazon Ish, just going back again on that idea about how the Yetzer Hara, the evil inclination for idol worship was eradicated. The Chazon Ish says that we shouldn't think that because we don't have the evil inclination for idol worship, that makes us greater than those who had it. I mean, they had a challenge of idol worship. They succumbed to idol worship. We don't have that challenge. And therefore, that gives us a step up on them. That makes us greater than them. It doesn't. Because basically, the Torah tells us, Yishmer lachem, guard yourselves, don't be seduced by idol worship. It's a mitzvah. The Torah tells us, don't be seduced. The Torah tells us you have a challenge. If you have a challenge, and you overcome that challenge, you fulfill the mitzvah, and you've grown. Which means, as much as idol worship could bring you down, if you overcome the challenge of idol worship, that becomes a stepping stone for tremendous growth. Because you've overcome that terrible Yetzirah. If you don't have that challenge, that means you don't have that opportunity of that kind of growth that comes out of overcoming that idol worship. And therefore, you're not on a greater level. You actually are missing out on the opportunity. Now again, the sages understood, they decided we can't handle it anymore. But automatically that created a drop in our level because no more would we be able to overcome that challenge and gain the growth that comes from that. And then Rav Schwab explains a mission Pirkei Avos in a very interesting way based on this whole idea about the end of prophecy and its effect. So we know that the first mission of Pirkei Avos tells us the Anshei Knesset HaGdailah used to say, have a mesuna madin, be very patient in judgment, v'amidu samidim harbe, and teach, raise up many students, v'asiu shag l'tara, make a fence for the Torah. So Rav Schwab says each one of these ideas that the Anshei Knesset HaGdailah were espousing were a result of the loss of prophecy. And he goes through each one. He says, basically, when prophecy existed, and many sages were prophets, if I understand correctly, following his whole approach, that because of the potential for prophecy, we were all on a higher elevated state. That means then that our ability to make decisions in Torah, it was easier for us. We had that elevated state, we had that elevated perception. Which means that when it came to making a judgment, we had an easier time of doing it because the power of prophecy helped our perception.
But we also have more challenges.
That's the challenge of idol worship.
Right.
Fine, but that doesn't mean though that if I'm not succumbing to idol worship and I'm in that elevated state and I have an elevated perception, then when I'm studying Torah, I'm going to have an easier time of getting to the decision I need to make. But once prophecy was gone and our level of perception went down, so now I'm assuming I did. Don't be so quick to make a decision. You got to be more patient now. You don't have that level of scholarship that you had before. Again, prophecy helped in the scholarship too, or the potential for prophecy helped in that. Hamidu samidim harbe, make a lot of students. When everybody was on a more elevated perception and scholarship was greater, then your pool for future leadership was, you had a good pool. You had enough, whatever amount of students that you were going to have was going to be enough, because whoever decided they were going to, instead of, you know, working on the farm or whatever it is that they were doing, they were going to dedicate themselves to becoming scholars and future leaders of the Jewish people. Whatever the amount of students were that participated in that, you knew that because of the elevated state of scholarship, the elevated potential for scholarship that came from the chemistry of prophecy that was part of our makeup, you knew that you'd have enough students to teach to become the future leaders. But once prophecy was lost and scholarship went down, now the Medrash tells us, Elif Nechnasin, you have Elif Nechnasin, I can't remember the exact expression, exact wording. And basically it says, Elif Nechnasin, you have 1,000 students entering the yeshiva, and only one of them comes out great enough to give hayra, to be a leader of the highest caliber. The loss of scholarship that comes from the loss of prophecy now says that, you know, you can have a lot of people studying, but you're not gonna, but to get the ones that you need for the future leaders, you don't have the same pool. You don't have the same percentage. And therefore, Hamida Samidim Harbin, you gotta teach a lot of students. Because you need, so to speak, the numbers, so that amongst those numbers you'll get more of those few that will really be truly successful to be the future leaders. But again, he's saying that's as a result of the loss of prophecy. Then you have Asus Shagla Torah, make offense for the Torah, which is the basis for, which is the whole idea of all the rabbinic laws that were made, right? On Shabbos, we don't ride on an animal. Why? Because we're afraid you're going to pull up a branch to use as a switch. Right, all the takanas, all the decrees that Chachamim made, so that we don't do things that are essentially permissible, because it'll lead to doing, it could lead to something, doing something wrong. So Rav Schwab brings down a mechilta on the pasuk v'shamru bnei Yisrael es haShabbos. The Jewish people will guard the Shabbos. That the word guard means that besides what's actually forbidden, you have 39 malachas, right, or 39 forbidden forms of work on Shabbos. The shamru also says, you've got to guard the laws to make sure they're not violated. You have the laws to observe, and then you have to guard them. The Shema, you have to protect them. You have to guard them. You have to do something to make sure they don't become violated. The Torah mandates that we do things to make sure that we don't come to violate the actual prohibitions, which is the basis for all the laws of all the rabbinic laws of Shabbos and other laws. Wait. So what he's saying is that when prophecy existed and we're on a higher level, so then that principle of guarding the Shabbos, that principle of doing, making precautionary measures that you don't come to transgress Shabbos, everybody did it on their own. They knew to do it on their own. They understood how to do it. They understood the concept. They appreciated the concept. They did it on their own. They didn't need the sages to institute it. But once prophecy was suspended, and the level of scholarship and perception and sensitivity, whatever you want to call it, became lessened, because our whole nature became lessened because we lost prophecy from our spiritual makeup, at that point the sages said, we have to now use our power that Torah gave us to actually make decrees and create those precautionary measures and establish those laws so the Jewish people don't come to do it. Because on their own, they won't be able to do it. So that's how he explains the concept. I mean, if you ever thought and wondered, you know, before the sages instituted all these laws, how come they weren't there before? So he said, they didn't need them. They didn't need them. Which I always understood it as, they didn't need them means, you didn't need to make precautionary measures. That's not what the Prophet is saying. You always need precautionary measures. The Torah always talked about precautionary measures. Didn't just talk about it as a potential for the sages to make. It's always there. The idea of precautionary measures not to come to violate an actual law is always there. But it was something that, so to speak, the Torah trusted we could do on our own. Because we were on that higher level. Once we slipped from that level, because prophecy was removed from us, now it was necessary for the sages to enact laws that would protect us from violating. And it actually now also created the need for the sages to create for us a formal text of davening, because again, we wouldn't be able to do it on our own. And doing it on our own doesn't mean, you know, if you're poetic, you can write your own little poem and that's going to be a prayer that's going to help you. There's much, what lies, the Nefesh HaChaim says that what lies in what the Chachamim instituted, the wording that the Chachamim used for the prayers that they made, the order that they made, has in it secrets and secrets and secrets of the Torah that we have no idea what lies in them, right? The prayers are meant to not just deliver a feeling from our heart. I mean, it's meant to do that also, but it's also meant to contain lots of spiritual power that allows our prayers to make the spiritual, you know, impact in the world that's necessary for us to deserve Hashem's blessing. There's much more contained in the prayers than just words by which we express our needs. There's much more in that. When the Jewish people were on the level, there was a level that they could do that themselves. But after prophecy was gone, so Reb Schwab, we didn't have that power anymore. And therefore it was necessary for the Chacham to step in and to use their wisdom, and for the prophets that were still there to use their wisdom to create the prayers for the Jewish people that would be the most effective for them for the rest of history. Okay. So, okay. One last thought. And that is, so Torah in the Parsha, like you said, talks about Karbanos. And the Torah talks about sacrifices, karbanos, that have to be brought when a person does something wrong, when he does a sin that's done unintentionally. So if you take a look, so let's take a look at page 558. Pasuk, I'm sorry, page 558. Pasuk Chaf Beis. Asher Nasi Yachda. When a Nasi, when a ruler, which means when a king sins, Ra'asa Achis B'chol Mitzvah Hashem Eloikav, and he does one of the commandments of Hashem is God, Asher Loisei Asena, they're not to be done. He does that unintentionally, v'ashem, and he becomes guilty. So the Torah says that when a king does a sin unintentionally, and he has to bring here a carbon katas, a sin offering for doing that unintentional sin, the king has his specific carbon katas, his specific sin offering that he has to bring. This is what he has to do. If it's the king who does it, this is what he has to do. He has to bring a seer easily, he's got to be able to bring a male goat, and the Torah tells us what he does. But the Torah has a specific carbon for the king who sins accidentally and needs a sin offering for atonement. And the Torah starts off with the word asher nasiyachta, which is translated as when a ruler sins. But Rashi brings down asher nasiyachta. The Torah using the word asher is actually alluding to something else. And that is Lashon Ashrei. Ashrei is related to the word Ashrei, fortunate. Ashrei hadar shehanasi shaloi noisein lev lovi karban al shegagasei. Fortunate is the generation that the prince bothers to bring an atonement for his mistake. Kal v'chaymer, all the more so when he regrets his intentional sins. For the Nazi, for the prince, to bring a sin offering, fortunate is the generation that has that kind of a king that's ready to bring a sacrifice for his sin. Now, we know that the Torah tells us if a Kohen Gadol does the same thing, he has his carbon that he brings. And if the Sanhedrin gives a mistaken ruling in certain areas of the Torah to the Jewish people, and the Jewish people act upon that ruling, they have to bring a special sacrifice. But no one says, but you don't find this concept of fortunate the people that the Kohen Gadol brings a sacrifice, brings an atonement for his sin. Fortunate are the sages who do this. You only say that this fortunate when it comes to the king. And it's very understandable. Because a king who is the ultimate power, for him to have to publicly come forth and say, I made a mistake, is not an easy thing. You know, the Kohen Gadol is a holy, holy man, right? He spends his, everything about him revolves around the Beis HaMikdash. All right? He's expected. It'd be expected if he did something wrong that he would come forth. But the king, the ultimate power, that person who has the ultimate power, for that kind of a person, it can be pretty difficult to come forth and admit a mistake. And therefore, one who does, the Torah is alluding, the Torah is saying, Ashrei, fortunate are the people who have that kind of a leader. Why? Why is it fortunate for the people that have that kind of a leader? Because he shows that he's sincere. It shows that the way he rules and the way he decides is not going to revolve around his reputation or his personal motives. He seeks the truth. He does what's right. And if it means he has to embarrass himself because he needs an atonement, that's what he's going to do. So it's fortunate for the nation because they have such a person, but it also means that they know that this person is going to be judging them in an objective way. And he's not going to be tainted by personal motives. When Moshe Rabbeinu was told to go to Mitzrayim and tell the Jewish people, and deliver to the Jewish people the message that Hashem is going to take them out of Mitzrayim, so Moshe says, they're not going to believe me. So Hashem gives him three signs. The first sign was that his stick, throw a stick down, and the stick would be thrown down, and it would turn to a snake. Says Rashi, what did that mean to say? What was the message behind that? Rashi says, it was a message to Moshe that, you know, you spoke Lashon Hara. You're like the snake. The snake spoke, it used its tongue in the wrong way, spoke against Hashem, caused Adam and Chava to sin. You're following the actions of the snake because you spoke Lashon Hara about the Jewish people. Next sign was, supposed to take his hand, put it against his chest, take it out, his whole hand is stricken with saras. Why? Says Rashi again. Message to Moshe. He spoke Lashon Hara against the Jewish people. Saras is a punishment for speaking Lashon Hara like we find by Miriam. And the third one was about taking the water and pouring it on the floor, becoming blood, and that had more to do as a message about the plagues for the Egyptians. Okay? But Moshe was supposed to do these to the Jewish people. When Moshe Rabbeinu would come to the Jewish people, he was going to do these signs in front of them to prove to them that he was appointed by Hashem to be the leader. But Hashem is telling him basically, do these signs, right, that were signs to say that you spoke Lashon Hara, that's what you're doing in front of the Jewish people. That means the signs that are proving your leadership are the signs that actually said to you, you made a mistake in your leadership. Which means that Moshe wanted Moshe, when he was going to show to the Jewish people that he's the leader, to show them, actually, Hashem wanted him to publicly say that I have to be ready, to admit my mistakes. I have to be ready to publicize mistakes if need be.
But the Jewish people didn't know that.
I would assume that whatever message lied for Moshe in doing the snake and doing the saras, right? That message, the Jewish people would be explained what the message was about. Like, what's the point of each message? So they would also be told what the message was about. So Moshe is now publicly, basically showing, Hashem is telling Moshe, you have to publicly show the mistakes that you made. Which could mean that Moshe Rabbeinu was supposed to be showing the Jewish people that as your leader, I have to be ready to admit that I made a mistake. I have to be ready to show you, be ready to make it known to you that I made a mistake. Which helps the Jewish people again realize that their leader is meant to be a person of sincerity, a person who is righteous and not arrogant and not self-motivated. It was all part of the message of his leadership to the Jewish people. But together with that message that the leader, part of the message of the Jewish people were getting that the leader is supposed to admit his mistakes. He has to be ready to publicize if he did something wrong. Which again shows them the sincerity of the leader. I think what it also meant to show them was that when you see your leader admit his mistake, don't say, oh, you can't be our leader anymore. You're not worthy of being our leader anymore. You make that mistake and you can't be our leader if you made that mistake. The message of the Jewish people was, number one, the leader has to be ready to admit his mistake, and they should know that he's sincere, but at the same time, when he admits his mistake, that doesn't become now a reason to say, well, if he did this, how can he be a leader? Leaders can make mistakes. And if they're ready to admit to it and are sincere about it, they are still worthy of being your leaders. So, my understanding here is that there was clearly the fact that Moshe now had to display his mistakes in public meant to carry this message of the fact that the leader has to be ready to admit his mistakes. The Jewish people should realize when they're getting their leader what kind of a leader they're supposed to have, and at the same time realize even with those mistakes he's still worthy of being the leader.
I don't understand the first and the second. I don't understand how they got the third.
The third is a different kind of message. That's pretty clear from the way Rashi says it.
No. This third statement that you just made, why then the third that he should be allowed to continue to be a leader?
Because why would it? Because the point was that Moshe was admitting his mistakes here, right? And he was still being the leader.
Right, okay.
Still being the leader. One quick thought. You know, there's a famous story in the beginning of the Sefer Shmuel, where Hannah is davening in the Mishkan,
drunk,
and Eli accuses her of being drunk, and she says to Eli, she says, "Lo Adoni, I'm not shikar, I'm not drunk. Lo Adoni, no, my master, Isha, I'm a woman who's very bitter." Rashi on the words "Lo Adoni" says that she spoke very sharply to him, and she said, "Lo Adoni, you're not my master in this. You're if you can't recognize that I'm not drunk, then your Ruach HaKodesh is off." Then afterwards, she apologized for being so harsh by saying, "Please don't take me to be an evil person. I'm very bitter." Eli says to her, "Everything's going to be fine. Everything's going to be good." She says, basically says to him, according to Rashi, says, "Please daven for me." And the Torah says she went back to her husband and family, went back to her husband, and her sad face was gone. And she was now able to be joyous and partake of the Yontif Karban. So, my Shiva, Revelius Feizatzal, said a very interesting idea. He said, Eli blew it. He blew it in front of this woman, big time. But when he says to her afterwards, everything's going to be fine, she accepts it undoubtedly, unquestionably. That's because even if he made a mistake, it doesn't take away, it doesn't invalidate him. You know, at the same time that the Jewish people, it's important to know, a leader has to be ready to admit his mistakes, right? That doesn't become an excuse for other people to say, you know, he's not admitting his mistake because he's not agreeing with you. No, it's not become an excuse for you not to challenge your leader by saying, oh, he's not admitting his mistake. So it's the leader, if he's a real leader, he means it sincerely, he's not being arrogant, he's got to be ready to admit his mistakes. And the Jewish people should know that. But by knowing that, they know he's sincere, and at the same time, realize that even if he makes a mistake, he is still worthy of being their leader.
Depends how many mistakes he makes, too.
To be?
Rabbi, Navi, that prophet, you're prophesizing the future.
Not necessarily. Navi is often prophesizing the future, but he's also delivering a message from Hashem.
Yeah, when Hashem dictates you the book to write, it's...
You know, a lot of times, typically it talks about something in the future, but not necessarily. I mean, it could just be a message.
Like Jonah and the whale and so forth.
Well, again, there was a warning, you know, you're going to get messed up, you know, so there is a future message in there. But again, it's more about you had a special communique from Hashem, and you delivered that to the Jewish people, and you delivered it in a way that they realized that this came from Hashem.
No,
you know, it's not just, you know, some guy getting up on a box and, you know, screaming and somehow or another getting people into it. They see it on you. it's not like you're prophesizing at the time, but they see on you that your message is not just something that you're making up here. It came from Hashem.
And Jonah, you know, he was told from the past what will happen in the future. The people in the past, you know, were not perfect people. It was God was going to destroy the city. So his job was to go there and tell the people, you have to change from how you were in the past. So you wouldn't be.
But that was, he was delivering a message from Hashem.
Right, right.
Okay.
So.